Okay, well, welcome everyone. And as I said, there may be some more people joining, but we're going to get started and go from there. Of course, this is the bi-weekly PLC. Some of you may be new. We have a mix of new people. We've got alumni, and we've got some mentors that have done an awesome job over the years in job training. The whole idea of the PLCs is to get together informally and talk about some of the issues and problems we have. This time of the year, we're on a new cycle, and this is the third call in this cycle. And we're going to be focusing on the RFA that will be issued hopefully later this summer. We might talk about that a little later. We're going to be focusing not only on that, but and how to respond to that based on what we've seen in the past as far as guidelines. But we're also going to be focusing on best practices. And for those of you who are alumni, which we really value you as mentors in these discussions, but we also throw out ideas, and people might have something you may want to try to tune up your program to make it a little more efficient, or something you've thought about, but you just haven't gotten around to it, and you're thinking maybe we should try some of these ideas. So while we're going through it, we kind of follow through best practices and pretty much the ranking criteria. There'll be hints and tips along the way and issues. Now, we do ask everyone, don't put us on hold, but put us on your silent. I think it's, for most of you, it's #6 or *6, I think, because we'll pick up everything in the room inside conversations. We like open mics because if you have a question at the moment, you could break in, and the service we use also allows for open mic. So your mic is hot, but we do encourage conversation. This particular session, as I said, has more to do with the RFA that may be coming out later this summer. After that RFA, and we're going to be doing several more of these every other week leading to that, after that we switch over in the fall to best practices, and we have our grantees talk about their programs, highlight their successes, and talk about their issues. So, but right now, we really want to focus that. So today we're going to be talking about labor market assessment. And before we get started, we always talk about news from Washington. I do want to remind everyone, if you're not getting post-session notes, send us your contact information, hmtri@eicc.edu. hmtri@eicc.edu. If you have a copy of notes or any of the invites, just return that with your contact information. If you want to be removed or added, or you know someone who wants to be added, just click on any of the correspondence you get from us, whether it's one of our invites or post-session notes, which will be sent out to you on Friday. Just return that and tell us what you'd like to see, what questions you might have, or someone you know that you'd like to put them on the contact list, and we'll make sure they're on our PLC contact list, and they'll get notes and invites every other week. We do meet here, same time, same place, same phone number, every other week. So our next one will be July 28th, and we're going to be talking about partnerships and leveraging, which is really important to this program. As I said, today we're going to talk about labor market assessments. We always start out with any news from Washington. And Steve, you want to kind of give us an update of what's going on in EPA and HMTRI and some of our grantee news? I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. All right. Thanks, Mike. And good afternoon or morning, everyone. I guess the people in Alaska, it's still morning. The first thing that we've been kind of keeping track of is what's going on with the National Brownfields Conference 2021. Keep looking for signs as to whether it's still on or what's the story. And this week, we just got an announcement saying that they're looking for nominations for the Brownfields 2021 Phoenix Awards, which there's a nomination application that due date now, that's September 3rd, and then all winners will be notified on or before November 1st and then announced at an evening event on December 10th. So this is directly connected to the National Brownfield Conference. So Mike and I looked at that as a positive sign, like this event was still on and planning to go. So unless there's something that comes up that would derail this, it looks to us like it's that's a good sign to for the conference to be moving forward.
Could you repeat the dates for the submissions again?
Sure. Yes. Let's see. The submission dates are nominations are due by September 3rd, 2021. All winners will be notified on or before November 1st, and then they will be announced at an evening event on December 10th. And if you go to the nationalbrownfieldsite.org, they've got the Phoenix Award nomination application right there.
We'll put all this contact information and URLs in the post-session notes. And just a quick insert. Jenny, is there anything you want to add to what Steve just said about Brownfields?
Yeah, so the registration is actually going to open August 9th. So registration for the Brownfields Conference, and that's going to be on the website as well, brownfields2021.org, just so people are aware of that.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yep. No, that's great. Okay. So then from HMTRI, we mentioned a couple weeks ago, we were talking about how we're in the process of putting together a scan to update the grantee contact information, basically the grantee directory, and also the social media directory. And we have combined the two so that we only have to contact you the one time rather than multiple times to look for the information. And we're going to be using a Google Forms. So you'll be getting an email from us probably next week asking your help in completing the grantee directory information. So look for that next week. Also, to follow probably within a week or so after that, we're also doing a end of year. This is the end of our first year of the grant project for us, and we will be sending out a brief evaluation to kind of get your feelings on how we're doing and whether or not you're getting what you need from us. Basically, just kind of checking to see that we're kind of on target. And so that'll be going out next week. Also, it'll be going out in a Google Forms that'll be embedded in an email. You can also go to Google Forms. Also, you'll have a link to that so you can fill it out in either place. But that'll really help us kind of take a look at where we are, review our progress, and we look forward to your input, too, on not only things we're doing right, but if there's any things we can do to improve or add to what we do to help you, we look forward to your input. Also, we found out recently that one of our favorite grantees, Ronique Haney, actually of the West End Neighborhood House of Wilmington, Delaware, many of you may know him, fantastic person, but he informed us that he was leaving his position at the West End Neighborhood House, and we're sorry to see him go, and we'd like to thank him for all of his contributions to the professional learning community. And you may recall that he's also shared videos of his project at the all grantee meetings, etc. So he's a fantastic person, and we just wanted to share a success story that he shared with us on one of these PLC meetings. And basically it was talking about a fall cohort in 2019 that was his first one at West End Neighborhood House. And he was serving as a recruiter, case manager, and also did job placement. And they put together a curriculum, and it was a five-week program. They were able to recruit 17 students, and they graduated all 17. And through the first 6 months after the fact, they had seven of those students already placed. And one of the students was really a success story because this was a person who was during training for asbestos abatement worker. He was working as a waiter at a local restaurant making $2.50 an hour plus tips. and he completed the asbestos abatement worker program and got a job with the School District of Philadelphia, earning a starting salary of $48,791, plus comprehensive medical benefits, paid holidays, vacation, leave, and he was enrolled in the state retirement system. So pretty nice bump up to go from 250 plus tips to a salaried position. And that starting salary is $48,791. And after the first year, it would go up to $52,464. So there was also a nice bump. He had health insurance also, paid biweekly, a Monday through Friday work schedule. So he was really happy about that, and that was a success story. So those are the kinds of things we really, you know, enjoy hearing. So we appreciated him sharing that with us. Then lastly, a question that has come up from time to time is, can I require program participants to be vaccinated before entering the EWDJT program? And as you can imagine, there's lots of different perspectives on this, and some of the answers depend on location, state, city, et cetera. And we're really curious to know feedback, how other grantees are handling it. We've heard from some that are requiring masks and social distancing, but not requiring vaccinations as a condition of acceptance in the program, but it may vary depending on, again, your location and specific issues you're dealing with. So just thought we'd open that up and see if anybody had any comments or can tell us maybe what they're doing. Well, Mike, I don't know if you want to add anything to that or.
Well, you know, there has been differing. I think the consensus, and we've on previous PLCs, we've always asked people what they're doing, and I think the consensus is, since we don't have full authorization, we're authorized for emergency use of the vaccines, but not full authorization. I think the general feeling is, we really can't require, or we're not requiring that they be vaccinated to enter this program. That's kind of been the consensus. And we've asked even the question of grantees, could you use it as a screening method? For example, you've got 30 people and you can only bring in 15. And you would do, if you were to ask the question, you know, have you been vaccinated? They don't even want to go there. Grantees are reluctant to go there. The law is not clear. It's really dependent on state and local. And really, the easy answer is refer to your state and local. Now, it's interesting that the colleges, you know, University of California, many colleges are falling into, because they've got 20,000 people on site, they're falling into the vaccination requirement. But for the most part, people are not requiring as a condition of entrance into the program. They are, though, looking at social distancing within the program. I think we do have open mics, so I think we have to, there we go. So we are seeing many of the grantees keeping their social distancing, their reduced class size, perhaps masks, depending on local conditions. Once they're in the program, they may be doing more outside work. So it's this hybrid situation we're in. Until we get that full authorization, I think we're going to be in the situation where, again, most people are saying, well, it's not a condition for entry into the program. We're really encouraging you to get vaccination. But just the same, we're going to be trying to enforce, if we're going to be working in close quarters, we'll be using masks, or we're continuing the work we did during the pandemic, and we're going to keep separation and distances. So that's kind of how that's being resolved, and we're going to keep up with that question as we go. But that's pretty much an issue that all of you who are existing grantees or new grantees are going to be facing. The reason,
Mike, at Santa Fe Community College, I'm requiring people to be vaccinated to be as a condition of acceptance.
Very good. And you haven't got any blowback or anything from the state or local or the students or anything like that? Are you happy?
No, the state state was really glad that I was doing it that way.
Excellent. Okay, very interesting. Okay. Santa Fe, New Mexico. So, your students? Yes.
This is Angela at Pathstone. One of the issues that you have to consider is your employability, because if the employers in your local area are requiring vaccinations and you train people knowing that they're not vaccinated, then they're not employable in that region.
Interesting concept. A good idea. That would be no different than, say, drug use. Are you going to tolerate drug use if they can't be placed? You know, the big thing now is some employers are accepting people who have marijuana, where obviously if you're doing DOT or anything, transportation, that's not a go. And why train someone if you can't place them? Very good point. Any other ideas on that?
Hello, Mr. Mike?
Yes.
Hello? Okay, my name is Pat Brown, and I'm from Ohio. And I work with the State Department of Health. And I currently have a green training program where I'm teaching youth about urban agriculture, and they're working in the garden throughout the summer. It's high school students. And what we're doing is we're having the parents sign an agreement that either the children that are vaccinated, they do not have to wear masks, but the children that's not vaccinated, we're leaving it up to them as an individual choice. But we're having them sign off on like an agreement to be a part of the program that, you know, if you're not vaccinated, it's your option. We suggest that you wear a mask, but it's your option. You know, so we leave it up to them to make that decision. So there's no liability on us or the company.
A good point.
Yeah.
Almost that's like a disclaimer.
State, that's a state and local. That's going to vary by what the law is, state and locally.
Right.
Right, because here in Ohio, I mean, we do not have to wear masks. Like outdoors, we don't have to wear masks. Those that are like vaccinated, you know. So we're kind of leaving it up to the parents in that case. However, in most establishments, when you go into most businesses, they require that you wear masks. So as a disclaimer, to be a part of our program, where we're getting them, we're having them make that decision and leaving the responsibility up to the individual.
So you're having them sign a release. You know, you may want to check with the local community colleges and seeing what's in your community, what seems to be appropriate. So you're not really going against the grain, as Janet did. She's got clearance from above. That, yeah, this is the way to go. It's almost between a rock and a hard place. You would hate to have people infected by not requiring them, but then at the same time, you've got this issue that some people are bringing up about, well, it's only authorized for emergency use. So, again, that's probably, as you just said, in Ohio, it may be a local issue, and it's something you may want to check before you get too far into this. In your recruitment for new grantees and even existing grantees, of what seems to be the standard in your community. And it sounds to me like it may vary. The idea is a good one of a release. If people require it and the community colleges are requiring it and the colleges are requiring it, there's a precedent for you. If they're not, there might be another precedent, and you would not want to get into a lawsuit of some sort and be the the only man out that's not doing what the standard practice is in your community.
Right, because most of the students, they're working outdoors, but in indoors, we require them to wear the mask. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. I guess it kind of varies for them.
Well, we'll keep up on this, and we'll and I think the best thing we do is talk to each other and see what seems to be the best practice around the country. One of the reasons we wanted to shout out to Reinecke, but another reason we wanted to talk about, and we'll put in the post-session notes, his anecdotal story was he accredits his placement ability to a new needs assessment. They overhauled their needs assessment, and the administrators and case managers got together and said, maybe we need to go back and review how we're doing needs assessment. And that kind of brings us into what we're talking about today. And this is the ranking criteria. We're just beginning as far as what we may anticipate when the new RFA comes out. We're assuming it'll be fairly similar to last year's, and we're going to go along the guidelines as when they are issued. We will fine-tune this, but right now we're kind of using last year's guidelines because, and the reason we're doing it so early or before the RFA comes out is because many of these things take much more than 60 days to implement. When the RFA comes out, two things are going to happen. You have 60 days and you have to submit your grant, and you can't talk to your regional coordinator about your specific community. They can have some Zoom meetings and they could have some conferences with a lot of people, but they can't talk to you specifically about it. Before that RFA comes out, you can talk to your regional coordinator about your specific issues in your grant. And you may want, we'll put their names and phone numbers, they're always in the post-session notes, so you can talk to them before that RFA comes out. But today we're talking about this. Last week, or last PLC, we talked about the community need, and we focused on community assessment. There's two parts to this ranking criteria, and for those of you who are not at all familiar with the EPA, Environmental Workforce Development Job Training, the way they evaluate proposals, there's a cover letter, which is about 3 pages, and there's 15 pages of ranking criteria where the real evaluation goes on, and then there's 15 pages of attachments. The threshold criteria pretty much feeds, it kind of filters out the people who really don't qualify for this program. And we talked about that a couple of PLCs ago. The threshold criteria, once you pass that screen after 15 days, you go into the real nuts and bolts of the program, the ranking criteria. And last year, I believe there's about 109 points, and it's very, they try to make it as objective as they can, and they very as quantitative as they can, and they will rank, and we're going through each of those ranking criteria. But before I say that, after I say that, the way we're approaching it is holistically. We're going to be talking about community need today, but community need, in preparing for that, you're going to get a whole lot of other things you need to do to write a successful grant. You'll see what I'm saying in a minute. Last PLC, we talked about the community assessment, and that there's 20 total points that they assign to ranking criteria, and 10 of those is for community assessment, choosing your target community, and then the other 10 are labor market assessment, the labor demand. And it's the old question, you know, if we build it, will they come? And if they come, where are we going to be targeting our training and our program? Well, today we're going to talk about the labor market demand. And when we do that, these are the foundations of this entire program. Where are you going to train? What are you going to train? And will these graduates have jobs when they leave the program? And you've got to think of it in those terms. And when you start talking about what we're doing today, just don't talk about, we don't want to talk about the 10 points for doing a labor market demand. We want to look at it and how it may affect other responses we'll have in this RFA. If you look at the RFA when it comes out, they assign these 10 points. They ask you, well, what degree do you understand the job market? They assign about 3 points to that. What methods are you using for you doing your labor market assessment? 3 points. The extent that you're incorporating the application, labor market assessment into the application and curriculum you decide to use, and then to what extent does the labor market assessment synchronize with your target? Well, what we want to do is talk about how all of these four things that I mentioned can be incorporated in doing a comprehensive labor market assessment. And let's talk about what that is. There's an easy side to it, and there's a difficult side to it. The easy side is you go to the WIB, the Workforce Investment Board, and you go to the Job Training Center, and you get some statistics about the need for different occupations they may have listed, and you say, oh, yes, there is a need, and here's the numbers, and here's a projected need. And that doesn't hack it. That does not hack it. The hard part is what we need to talk about today, and that's getting into potential employers.
No, I think we may have to have
someone put their phone on mute. We do have open mics, and someone having a side conversation. Okay, there you go. Put your phone on mute, please.
Well, you know, she.
We've got. Okay, everyone will have to ask you to put your phone on mute because we don't control it we're using now. So I'm going to repeat that a couple of times. If someone's listening, could you put your phone on mute? Okay. Well, hopefully you got the message. Star six usually puts your phone on mute. Okay. We'll continue. So, again, I'm going to repeat one more time. Please put your phone on mute if it's not on mute now, because we're going to pick up every conversation in the room we're in. So, getting back to this labor market.
You go, Prieto.
What are we trying to do with your labor market?
Yes.
We're going to try to... ma'am? Okay, we're going to have to put your phone on mute, please. Okay. These are open mics, and we've got a lot of people on the call, and we're picking up peripheral conversations. So we'll try to go on. Otherwise, we're going to pick up everybody and every conversation in the room. So, okay, we'll try to get through this. Could you, anyone that's listening, could you put your phone on mute?
Blown out of proportion.
Can you
Why is she even on the call if she's not even listening right now?
Yeah, this is a good discussion. At some point, she got us on. She's doing her homework or something. And,
must be a state employee.
If she's listening, can you put your phone on mute, ma'am? Hopefully she'll go silent. Please put your phone on mute because we're hearing your side conversations. This could be kind of fun. It depends on what that side conversation is.
Hello.
But she's having a party now. Okay. Well, I'll try to talk over.
Don't tell me that. No,
I won't, but you know how this city is.
I think you're going to talk over it, Mike.
I think I'm going to have to, you know, because she's got a side conversation going on. Okay. Well, please bear with me.
Fine. Thank you.
Again, if you could hear me, ma'am, can you put your phone on mute? There. Ah, very good. She heard me. Okay. Oh, nope. So please put your phone on mute. Okay. This may be what will make us go over to Zoom. If we've done this for years, and every once in a while we'll get something like this. And we do like open mics, but and the old technology, but we may have to go the other route. Okay, well, Getting back to this labor market assessments, what are we trying to do with it? We're trying to expand our reach. We're trying to promote. Ma'am, can you put your phone on mute?
My inspection for my report's supposed to be in 24 hours or so.
Ma'am?
Laptop has
can you hear me?
Working.
No, she may have us on mute.
Can you mute everyone?
I can mute everyone. Maybe that's all I have to do. Let me do that. We'll just mute the audience. I'm sorry for this. I'm going to put you all on mute. We'll go from there.
I'm an assistant.
Oh, okay. There we go. Sorry for that interruption, but it's this may be the way to go. And then I'll unmute you in a little while. Again, when we look at the labor market assessment, I want to look at it in a holistic way. And as long as we're building this labor market assessment, let's not just answer those four questions I talked about. Do you understand how it how it works in your curriculum? Does it sync with your target group? Let's use it. And because it is a foundation for your entire program, let's use it as a way of building your program. And the whole thing is the labor market assessment can be used as a way of developing partnerships, certainly finding your employers, a way of community awareness, a way of getting the information about the program you're proposing to do out to people. It's a great opportunity to tell the community, this is what you're going to be doing. And it's also not only you going out to the community, but a way for the community to tell you, this is what we would like to have, and particularly the employers. You want to find out what potential employers are going to be in your area or your community they're going to be hiring, and what are the skills and knowledges that they want. For example, and I'll unmute later, we could talk about this, but for example, if you're in a community like Janet is, where you may be training people that need security clearances or they may have to get into homes, that may influence your screening ability. If you're going to be accepting ex-offenders, you have to be aware of that. You may have to find employers who are willing to work with ex-offenders. So you need to find out from them, first of all, what are the restrictions on getting for them employment? What kind of minimal first hire skills and knowledges do they need? Are there people they won't look at? Are there people they will look at? And the purpose of this needs assessment is it gives you an opportunity to find out who are people who would like to work with your community. And who are the people who really can't? And that, it's not bad. You may find people that, oh, I can't accept those people, or we just hire engineers, or we're going into homes and we have to have people with clean records, or we certainly can't accept drugs. You may also find people who said, we want to work with ex-offenders. We don't mind if they're have marijuana use as long as they're not on other drugs. They may have other restrictions. They may say, we want people who can work in confined spaces. We want a certain, we're kind of favoring a certain ethnic group. So this is an opportunity when you do your labor market assessment to find out who in your community you can work with and who probably you can't work with. Why waste your time on people who can't hire your graduates? And focus on those groups of employers that are interested in your graduates. They want to work with your people. They want to contribute to the community. They believe in environmental justice, and they'll help you. So this is a big part of this labor market assessment. And this is the hard part I was talking about. The easy part's going to the WIB, getting numbers, and the quantitative numbers are good. The hard part is getting into the community and actually identifying employers. And as you get to see these employers, some you're going to say right away, they're not for our group. here is someone, they're a tank manufacturer, and they work with hazardous materials, and yes, I can zero in on them, or they're a hospital with many branches, and they're interested in people that have our skills, or they're a deconstruction firm or construction firm, and they're working with lead and asbestos, and they're willing to work with our people, and they need people. Those are the ones you want to take this broad thing and you want to zero in on those people. And what do you want to do? You want to go from general to specific. As you find those that'll work with your program, now you start going to these individuals and say, well, how interested are you? Are you really interested in our program? And they might say, I'll hire everyone you can graduate. I need people, or I'll look at your people. And they may be so interested, I'll help you with your program. I'll donate equipment. I'll become a leverage partner. I'll support you, because if they have HAZWOPR and OSHA 10 and maybe RRP, they may have several thousand dollars worth of certifications that me as an employer are going to get free, and I want to pay back to your program. So I will perhaps donate equipment. I'm maybe an employer that's working with emergency response. I could let you use our hazmat suits. You could use our pad. We can work with you. We could even send you some instructors. We need your people, and we'd like to control the curriculum. So we'll be happy to work hand in hand with you as a training partner, as a guest trainer. We'd like to participate. So as you see what I'm doing, I'm going from general to specific, and now I'm going to get real specific. You want to start asking them, can you support our program, or to what degree can you support it? Are you just interested in looking at our graduates, or are you really into our program? Then you get into the fact is, before those conversations are over, can you become an advisor for us? We're building an advisory board, and we'd like to get that advisory board set up before we apply for the grant. And if we could use you on our advisory board, and again, as I've always said, go forward with this grant application for those of you who are going to be submitting as if you're going to get it. You always assume you're going to get it. And if you don't, the response is, there's always a hesitancy, well, I don't have the grant yet. No, you want to set it up early. And if you don't get it, you say, we're going to try again next year. The beauty of this program, we're going to talk to our regional coordinator. We're going to find out what we're going to do wrong. We're going to expand it, and we're going to be back in business next year. So you want to build your advisory boards if you can, get your trainers on board if you can, do it before you apply for the grant, because then you could put it into your grant if you do that. And we're going to talk about that in the next PLC when we talk about partnerships. But again, you want to then see if these employers, would you be interested if we're going to apply for this grant, could you write us a support letter? Could you do this? And in that support letter, would you be willing to look at our graduates? I'm not committing you to hire our graduates. He may say, well, we'll hire them. I'll put that in writing. Or he may say, I'll look at them, or I'll come to your graduation, or I may come to some of your sessions and see if they're a fit for our organization. So if you see what I'm trying to do here, I'm going from very general, and I'm bringing this funnel down to very specific. Now, you're going to ask, well, you're pretty far away from those 10 points you talked about earlier. Not really, because what you're doing is you need this information to answer those questions, but it's going to answer a whole lot of questions on other ranking criteria. And to the extent you can get your support letters locked in now when you do your needs assessment, to the extent you can get your leverage partners locked in, now rather than waiting till you try to answer another question, you're going to get all the data you need, and you're doing it in one fell swoop. So as I'm saying, you're doing a lot of work, the hard part, but it's going to pay back when you do all this, both of you, for existing grantees and grantee alumni and potential grantees. You're building this knowledge base that you're going to be able to use in responding to the entire grant when the 60 days starts to click. You're going to have all this data, and you're going to have your potential employers lined up. You're going to have the numbers. The other thing is you're going to be able to talk to these employers about what they would like to see in your curriculum. you don't, here's our curriculum, we're going to build it and you're going to come. Not really. You're going to talk to the employers and they may say, we'll take everything you have, or we'll take some of your graduates, but they got to have confined space. Well, you might be thinking, well, we weren't thinking of that, but we'll include it. Or it's got to have lead. Or this is a new town, we don't have lead in this town, so you don't bother with that. So your employers, as you zero to the serious ones, are going to help you develop the curriculum. It will also influence your target group. If you need people who have certain conditions for employment, that will go back and it'll influence your, again, in community need and your target group. If you're working with asbestos workers, for example, you have an asbestos contractor and he's got lots of work and no employees, and he needs tall people that can keep their hands above their heads for a long period of time, it may not only affect your curriculum, but it may affect your screening process, and you may have to say, well, there's lots of employment opportunities, and it'll be in asbestos, you're going to work in hot weather, and you're going to have your hands over your head for long periods of time. The person entering that program says, that's for me, or they might say, that's not for me. So you see how, again, we're working backwards. We've always said you work backwards from employment. It's a jobs program. You work backwards from employment to the employer needs, to your curriculum, and then the people that could be successful in that curriculum. So again, we're working backwards and we're looking at the whole thing holistically rather than ranking criteria by ranking criteria and trying to answer a question. We've got the whole package together. You're going to ask me the next question though, is how do I find all these people? How do I find them? And the one thing about environmental jobs is, and I'll tell you, when I was first hired at EPA many years ago, I was in the public health service, and I was called a sanitarian, of all things. What the heck was a sanitarian? And here's the problem. You go to Dictionary of Standard Occupations, and it's not very definitive when it gets to environmental occupations. And one of the reasons is it's a sub-occupation in many ways. For example, the certifications that your student's going to have, they could fit into many, many traditional occupations. They could be painters. They could be welders. They may be railroad workers. They may be hauling hazardous materials in transportation. They may be in the scrap business. They may be flaggers on hazardous waste sites and directing traffic. They certainly may be remediators. One of the big problems with new grantees is they say, okay, this is an environmental jobs program, and we got to find job titles that say environmental remediator or asbestos technician is very specific, and you can find those, or lead remediator. But so many of the jobs, and some of the best jobs, are occupations that require all of the certifications that our graduates have. But if you're doing a job search and you go to Google, or even if you start doing any kind of surveying or look in the yellow pages of who's hiring the people that you're graduating, there's a mismatch. And this is a problem, particularly in communities where they say, well, there's no demand in our community. Well, wait a second. You don't have any hospitals. You don't have any painters. You don't have any manpower firms. You don't have any construction firms that might be working with hazardous materials or scrap yards, or you have no railroads, or you don't have any municipal facilities, whether they're power plants, wastewater plants. You mean to tell me you don't have any of those? Well, we didn't survey those because we didn't think that they would be hiring. Are the people, they aren't hiring necessarily an environmental technician. They're hiring people with all of the skills that you're giving them and all of the certifications, almost 100% match. So this is something you have to consider when you're doing your needs assessment. How are you going to reach to these non-traditional titles? And again, in the notes, we'll list a whole lot of these, whether they range from highway workers, self-responders, welders, you name it. You could almost name any occupation, and there's room there for someone, even bloodborne pathogens. Some of our grantees have found that many people were placed in hospitals or decontamination. Many in transportation, when anything that involved hazardous materials, our people fit into that. Certainly lead and asbestos, certainly things like the confined space. So you have to, when you do that needs assessment, again, go out of the box, and you're going to say, well, this is an awful lot of work, because you're asking me to almost survey the whole occupational title and you never know when this is going to pop out. It could be a tank manufacturer. It could be a deconstructor. It could be a construction firm. Could be anyone. So you've got to start looking. And good places to look are you start going through the internet. I used to say go to the yellow pages and see who is doing material handling types of things. Start looking at some of these communities. Now, ideally, if there are meetings, if you could get into the mayor's office and find out who their contractors are, who's doing work around the community, or go into your municipal agencies and seeing if they're hiring people that may need EPA or OSHA certifications, and that you would be a good source for them to look. That's, again, where you're going to be looking. As I said, once you find, and you don't have to find too many because you're placing a dozen, two dozen people, you start zeroing in on those who are potentially the most productive, whether they're electric utilities or remediation firms or whatever. And then you pick those. Then you have to remember, as a grantee, you're providing that employer thousands of dollars worth of certifications, employees that have been screened, have been tested with in terms of their interest in entering this occupation, with their stick-to-itiveness. You're providing them with a great labor pool with certificates that are worth several thousand dollars. So it's not all one way. I wouldn't say it's a challenge for you. It's right now in this labor market, it's a challenge for employers to find good people. So I'm going to unlock everybody, and we can talk about this a little bit more. Hold on. Can you all hear me? Is anyone there?
I can hear you.
Okay, can you all hear me?
Yes.
I can hear you, yes. Yeah.
Were you able to hear anything I said?
Yes.
clearly.
All of it.
Good.
All of it. That was a good point about the people that is looking for qualification in different markets, because it's so extend the different activities, and all are exposed to the hazards in general.
That's right.
And a lot of times they don't know what to do or how to approach to prevent or reduce cross-contamination or even direct contamination.
That's exactly right. And again, we're looking at a holistic approach, and we're calling it, labor market demand, labor market assessment. Now, you're going to be able, if you do what we just talked about, you're going to be able to answer all four of those questions. Don't worry about writing the grant right now. Worry about that when the RFA comes out, and we know exactly what it's going to say. But you've got these 4 points or 10 points. You can go right down that and you can click those things off with a high degree of certainty. What curriculum you're going to need? Well, you've already been told by the employers what curriculum they want. You're certainly going to be able to describe the methods you use. Yeah, you went to the quantitative places like the internet, and you went to the WIBs, and you got the general employment demand, but you went person to person. You're going to be able to supply letters of support from people who are look at your employees, your graduates. So you're going to be actually making your job down the stream much, much easier. And you're going to be laying the groundwork for all of the things that we talked about. And, of course, how does this sync with your target community? piece of cake, because you're going to work backwards and you're going to find out that you may have to change your target community. We talked about that the last session. You may find out that your employers don't sync with your target community, or the people you're planning on training just don't hack it with the people that are going to be hiring or want to hire your graduates. And you may have to go back and reconsider that. So anything worse is to train people who are unemployable, as we talked about early with the COVID vaccine issue, or there are just no jobs. You're training for lead and it's a new community and there's no lead in the community. You know. So again, treat when the RFA does come out, read through the whole thing and treat this holistically rather than individually, and try to build this knowledge, this database that you have.
Call Kirk back when I'm done with this one.
Anyone have any comments on that, or what their experience has been with labor market assessments and employers?
I want them doing this, which should be soon because he's been on almost an hour now. Then I'll call Kirk.
Here at ECA in Philadelphia, we have a challenge with the identify partners, properly partners for employment after the students are trained. So I don't know if anybody can give me a little feedback on something that is successful in other parts of the country. We're really struggling with that, no?
You're struggling at once they get employed or just after they're graduated?
After the students graduate from ECA on the different programs, we don't have a strong placement success for the students that graduate. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, again, this gets back to their labor market assessment. To the extent that you could lock in potential employers before you even start training, that makes it fairly easy. We have several grantees that have 100% placement before they even start. And they have worked backwards. They have been able, either lucky or fortunate or probably a lot of hard work, they've been able to identify a handful of employers that say, we'll take everyone you got, or we'll interview everyone you've got. That's easier said than done and requires, again, a big investment up front in this whole labor market assessment arena. You've got to find some angels that need people and the people. Now, those of you who are in urban communities are going to have a lot easier time than those of you in more rural communities. But it is possible. It is possible. You will also find some special programs out there that employers have that they say, we really are interested in helping people who are having difficulty or they're returning citizens. And we want to work with you, and we'll start a special program for that. So don't overlook the unions as a source, and what you might go to the laborers, or there might be a union in your town. And you would talk to the manager at that union and say, well, we're looking at a training program. And often they will help you depending on what the employment situation at the time. They may be looking for people who for pre-apprenticeships. And we have several programs that are have pre-apprenticeship programs. And we actually have programs that employees and organizations are providing stipends to students. You can't do that with EPA funds, but there are funds, private funds, that might provide either student training or internships or stipends, because they're looking for people with the credentials that you got. Again, the hard part is you've got a set of skills, very specific skills, and you've got to find the people who are looking for those skills. And that's why this whole idea of labor market assessment is the first thing that EPA is looking at in your grant. Is there a demand? You know, is there a demand? If there's no demand, if you can't identify employers that may be interested in the skills or certifications you're doing, you may have to rethink those things. You may have to change your curriculum or tweak it or provide some certifications where there's people. And as I said, the hard part probably is you probably have 1,000, maybe 10,000 or 20,000 employers. And how do you go down from 10,000 employers down to 5 or 10 that are willing and interested in your students with their skills? That's the challenge. Any other comments that anyone might have?
Yeah, Mike was right about not doing too narrow a search in jobs that have environmental in the title. One thing that we found out, not from employer partners, but actually from program alumni themselves coming back to us and telling them the kind of jobs that they've been getting or the jobs that are out there have been in other fields, related fields, but fields that we wouldn't have expected. In our area particularly, we were getting a lot of our trainees getting hired for oil rig and refinery work. And I know that that industry is problematic because it could be a net polluter, but they are looking for people with environmental services skills in order to maintain safety and prevent any kinds of accidents that would cause pollution. So it's still a net win for the program.
Exactly right. And in the notes, I'm going to put, we did a scan quite a few years ago of 16 grantees and asked them to just list the title that their graduates went into. And you're going to see two columns of almost every occupation, but, you know, environmental technician or the ones that you would expect. It's every other title. And it's what I said. It's in some respects, it's a non-traditional job. And it's almost like a sub-occupation of other titles, and you have to keep that in mind. So you don't want to get discouraged, but it does make your job harder in finding out where your graduates are going to be most valuable. And of course, you want to place your graduates in places where their certifications are valued because it'll get them a lot more money. You know, like Ronique, he happened to have a course in asbestos. A course in asbestos. He had a whole curriculum, but he had a course in asbestos. Someone needed someone with asbestos training, and it got him $49,000 a year with a career. So,
and
Mike,
that was with the city of Philadelphia, so that was a great job. Great job, great benefit.
Right. Right. So you don't know where it's going to come from, and the question is luck or is it skill? It's probably a lot of hard work. And for those grantees out there that are maybe on their third or fourth cycle, it's never too late to start hunting for people who have what you've got. And the one thing about awareness is the more mature you are, the word spreads of how good your program is, and, oh, you've got $5,000 worth of certs. The word starts to spread. Now, unfortunately, we haven't had meetings, but if you could go to, whether it's Florida Brownfields Association, you meet all of the national hires where they're constantly looking for people. When you go to Brownfields, you're going to see 60 contractors that are looking for people. And so that there's a lot of national firms. And as your communities gets more mature, as your graduates get into jobs, it makes your job easier. It's hardest for the first year because the word isn't out about what you've got to offer. Well, I don't want to keep you all too long. I do have to apologize. We had some interesting discussions we weren't looking for earlier in the time, but we'll meet again in 2 weeks. And if you have any comments or questions, just return the notes that you get on Friday, and we'll talk about them. Anything else before
thank
we
you very much.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Great information.
Thank you.
Have a great couple of weeks here.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
See you soon. Bye-bye.